The method.
Became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom. For those of you listening to the podcast for the first time, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow writers about their process and technique. And yeah, we're back after a bit of a hiatus at the end of 2023, but we've got a few more episodes lined up now for 2024.
We felt that if we just let 2023 ride itself out, all the problems would be solved and we could really just crack on in a fresh and enjoyable world. But it seems that everything's just picked over.
Are we maybe a little bit over-optimistic on that front?
To help us deal with that, though, this episode's guest is the writer David Shields, who has trodden a very interesting path of kind of distilling sort of cultural and political shifts and the currents that are bubbling away and writing about them in a really interesting way. The book that led me to him was called Reality Hunger, which I think is possibly his most well-known book over, certainly on this side of the Atlantic. And he's doing really interesting things there. I wouldn't want to tell people too much about it because I think, as I mentioned to him, there's a bit where the penny drops about what's going on with it. He's got a really interesting approach to the kind of sampling culture, I guess, that really was big in the 90s and for reasons of intellectual property and copyright has been completely killed. Everyone lawyered up. When there were some really interesting works of art being produced by this kind of synthesis of all these kind of disparate things being thrown together, high culture, low culture, he just writes really fascinatingly about it and just has a very interesting way of presenting the information and stuff that he's clearly really, really interested in. His latest book is about how we have got to the kind of political situation we're in, the kind of low value placed on truth, the benefits that can be gained from politicians lying, essentially. He's looking at sort of cultural theorists and what they have to say about it and about how the ideas that they've thrown out have come together and they result in the kind of populism that we've seen in lots of places where there is no cost to politicians saying these crazy things and maybe the effect that has on us culturally.
Yeah, I agree. And I think having read Reality Hunger, it's interesting on this podcast to talk, because obviously we're talking to writers of fiction for the most part, and a lot of his work would maybe be classified in a non-fiction section in a bookshop, say, but it really kind of hits the target in terms of that divide between fiction and truth. And that's, I think, what a lot of fiction writers are exploring, but he's doing it from a different angle. So he's in the same sort of sphere as a lot of the writers that are maybe writing, on the face of it, very different sort of books from what David writes.
Absolutely, yeah. And he talks about the fact that he grew up, I think he said his parents were journalists, and he decided that he was going to be a writer kind of in opposition to that. So he started off as a fiction writer, and then he realized, I guess, the value of what fiction is and what it's doing became a kind of conundrum for him. And he just very seamlessly shifted, it seems, into doing, or not seamlessly shifted, but he just kind of made that move into doing what he does very organically.
It did seem quite a strongly held belief in his youth to sort of rebel against that idea of journalistic truth. And to me, it always seems a very American thing. I don't know, in the UK, I don't think journalists are held in such regard as in America. They sort of see it as a pinnacle of truth, but he definitely seemed to be rebelling against that.
Yeah, I mean, he's been on a very interesting journey. He produces fascinating work, and here is our chat with David Shields. I guess a good place to start, because we're sort of talking about other writing to be done and things, and I know that you have previously been a novelist and feel that you've moved away from fiction writing. So I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about your story. I mean, I appreciate that the fiction, non-fiction distinction is a very murky area. I think we'll have some interesting stuff to say about that. But yeah, what's your sort of your route into writing?
Right. You know, I think some of this I've discussed, of course, before, either in interviews or in books, but it still interests me, my sort of the narrative of my narrative. And, you know, that both of my, it seems to matter to me that both of my parents were journalists or political journalists, and they wrote. Grew up in LA and San Francisco, and I saw them write, you know, hundreds, thousands of articles. And my very modest resistance or rebellion or was to declare journalism of no interest, that I would be a fiction writer, capital F, like, fuck you, sort of. And, you know, I'm going to write fiction. You know, I'm not going to drown in the drudge of reality. And so for 10, 15 years, I wrote fiction from maybe, what, 18 to 35, something like that. Undergrad, grad school, thought of myself as a fiction writer, albeit a somewhat autobiographical fiction writer, for sure. And wrote three novels from, say, 80 to 92. And, you know, they became, I think, increasingly collage-like or essayistic or genre blurring. And then I was trying to write my fourth novel in the mid-90s, and I had moved back to the West Coast. And somehow, variety of reasons, I don't know, somehow being on the West Coast again, teaching fiction at a university and finding that cumbersome and obligatory and dutiful. And then I think just the press, now, of course, it seems like a paradise lost, but at the time it seemed like a kind of onslaught of mass media, cable television, and the early rise of the internet and email, and kind of wall-to-wall media felt like, to me, a slightly new thing. I was trying to write a novel about all that in my late 30s, and it came out, I just could not write it as a novel. Anyway, so then I wrote this book, it was fascinating impasse where I could not write my fourth novel, try though I might, about it was about American mass media, and it was influenced by people like Kundera and DeLillo and Renata Adler and George Trow. But I just couldn't, I don't know what it was, fascinating. I just could not write it as a work of fiction.
You mentioned, you said running as a reaction in a way to your parents being journalists. Did you, in that period from 18 to 35, when you were writing as a novelist, did you have a clear dividing line in your mind that you were writing fiction as opposed to what was happening on the other side of the line, which was journalism, and that was the world of facts and different world than the one you were in on this side of the line? Or was that line always sort of slightly blurry?
I know what you mean. It seems awfully naive and simplistic now, looking back on what I've written, what I've theorized, what I've tried to practice, both in film and in writing, the way the conversation has morphed in the last half century, but especially maybe the last 30 years, both in theory, people like Jean Baudrillard, or people in essay or fiction. I think at the time I did have a relatively clear demarcation, although I somehow am flashing on this memory I had where I was reading in high school John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, and also simultaneously reading Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail 72. And to me, it was a fascinating moment where I found myself deeply bored by the Steinbeck, which seemed awfully, I've never been much of a Steinbeck fan, just seemed awfully hokey and very sentimental and very much, you know, capital F fiction. And then I was reading and loving Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail 72. I don't know if I would still like it, but I actually wrote Thompson a letter, and I said, I had an argument with my sister. It was kind of a fascinating precursor of all this, because I said, I really love Fear and Loathing, but surely some of this is made up, or, you know, you've taken enormous poetic liberties. And so I was living in the Bay Area, and Thompson, I don't know if he was in the Bay Area, he was probably living in Colorado then, or perhaps he's, but anyway, Thompson wrote a funny note that called me a pencil-necked geek. And I should have kept it. Maybe it would have some literary or commercial value.
I mean, that's the thing you want off on the wall.
He called me a pencil-necked geek, and then he insisted that there was a conversation in the book in which he has a conversation. There's a moment in the book which has a conversation with Richard Nixon at a urinal. And I said, to my sister, surely this is hallucinated or exaggerated. And he called me a pencil neck geek and told me and said it was true, which, you know, how would one ever know? I guess, would Nixon weigh in? Probably not. And I think I probably got it actually wrong. I don't know. I'd have to go and look at the passage. But to me, it was fascinating as a precursor of what I was would come to argue 30, let's see, that was 72. My God, 30 years later in 2010, let's see, 40 years later almost. And then I had a similar experience traveling, kind of a typical post-college traveling through Europe, like a backpack tour through Europe before starting grad school. And I remember having Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude, and I was simultaneously reading Proust's Remembrance of Things Past. I had a similar dichotomy where I found Garcia Marquez possibly admirable, but to me, deeply boring. I just wasn't interested in what Garcia Marquez was doing. I mean, I still am not really. I mean, I don't know. He's a much honored writer, et cetera, but it doesn't fundamentally interest me in the same way that Steinbeck fundamentally didn't interest me. But I was interested in Proust, who does seem, I ended up reading all seven volumes of it and loving it immensely. I still think it's the best book ever written. And I'm not directly answering your question, but those two moments are oddly emblematic for me, reading Steinbeck and reading Thompson, loving the Thompson, being bored by the Steinbeck, and then, but insisting that the Thompson was somehow fabricated, which is a weird thing. And then, let's see, maybe around, not that much longer, maybe 6 years later, I think, after graduating college, traveling, doing a kind of cliched backpack tour through England, France, Spain, etc. Before starting grad school, I had these two books in my backpack, and there too, finding the pure fiction somewhat tedious to me. Loving Proust, but insisting to myself that even though it's a novel, it's, you know, obviously a famously autobiographical novel to the point that you could read it as essayistic fiction or fictionalized essay in a way. It's so deeply autobiographical.
I'm sort of interested in that, the phase. I mean, we've talked about this sort of offline, not in interviews, about how sometimes you just read things or listen to albums or watch films at just exactly the right time. And the kind of ingredients in that might not necessarily be the thing that is always what you're after, but it just hits you for some reason in a sort of sweet spot. And it seems like you've sort of simultaneously done that in a positive way and in a negative way with something just really not hitting you. And that, I guess, being able to sort of the juxtaposition of those two things at the same time is interesting. I wonder if there's a sort of dialectical thing going on.
Exactly. It was the frisson between them that was everything. Like if I had just read Proust, I had said, okay, but it was the juxtaposition of them. I think that's exactly right. And I've had other similar moments. I think it was crucial that one felt dutiful or sort of conventionally approved, like the Garcia Marquez was probably the height of his popularity to an extent, you know, it was like so culturally sanctioned. It's not like Proust wasn't culturally sanctioned, but it was a slight anathema to not love Garcia Marquez at that time. And so too the Steinbeck. It's interesting that those two writers are Nobel Prize winners, you know, that meant and means nothing to me, you know. And so it was important to me to say, well, I'm more interested in Thompson, which is just kind of poetic journalism. And then I'm really interested in the Proust, which I'm going to insist on reading as essay. And then, you know, in a way, 40 years later, I kind of developed a whole theory. It's kind of fascinating, almost like there's something written into our DNA that's just there coming out. And it's like, took me a long time, three novels, which get increasingly unconventional. First one review called it almost a parody of a conventional novel. And then the second novel was kind of a buildings roman, kind of growing up book about a kid who had a horrible stutter, you know, kind of based on my childhood. Then the third book was a novel and stories called Handbook for Drowning, kind of revisits the same material as the second novel, but gathers them into 24 essays, stories, collages. And then, as I said, trying to write my fourth novel in the mid-90s, in my late 30s, I could not write the book. I sort of wrote it, but just wasn't coming together. And someone else, like, say, Jamie, who maybe has written a somewhat experimental novel, a la, say, I don't know, Nicholson Baker or Will Self or something like that. Someone else might have pivoted and written that book as a kind of experimental novel. You could argue that book to my first book is, I mean, that fourth book is kind of a novel, but it was published as Remote Reflections on Life in a Shadow of Celebrity, which, you know, I've reread it since it was published almost 30 years ago, but I still think it's probably a pretty good book. And I remember a friend of mine, the writer Jerome Stern, said, I don't know, I took it as wisdom at the time. He's a very good writer of brief essays and brief stories. I kept trying to insist it was a novel, and Jerry was reading early drafts of it and said, until if and when you commit to some kind of narrative motor here, it's best not to call this fiction. It really is a series of overlapping essays. And I mean, that might be kind of standard advice, because there are examples, of course, of books that go nowhere and are published as novels, like Zabald, you could say, or some Canal Scarred. I mean, I don't know. Are those books novels? Like, sort of? I don't know. Sort of not. Anyway, that was the big pivot for me in 96. That book came out as a work of nonfiction.
And I didn't have a pencil. My father didn't have a pencil. My mother didn't have a pencil. Their friends didn't have pencils, and no one had a pen. And then Willie Mays said, sorry, kid, ain't got no pencil, can't give no autograph. And then he left. And I was really very upset, I have to say, shaken. I was so disappointed. So disappointed that I actually cried in the car. It's a stupid response, but it was a big, big moment for me. After that day, I always made sure to walk around with a pencil in my pocket or a pen, because I didn't want to be caught unprepared again. And then I conclude, as I like to tell my children, that's how I became a writer.
Was there a moment where things kind of clicked in your head, or was slowly words came down on the page? You sort of realized, oh no, this isn't going to be a novel, it's something else. Or you got 90% through and suddenly there was an aha moment where you're, oh, wait a minute, I'm not writing a novel at all. I'm nearly finished writing this piece of nonfiction.
I know what you mean. I've sort of elided that rather huge discovery. I'm like, oh, gee, it's nonfiction. How could I have realized that? It's a great question, Lachlan. I think it took me a long time. I must have been working on that book for, let's see, maybe from easily 6 or 8 years on and off. And I think what happened is that it was heavily under the influence, as I say, of Kundera's Unbearable Lightness of Being and sort of DeLillo's White Noise, as I said earlier, and also Renata Adler's Speedbone. And so, to a degree, also George Trow's Within the Context of No Context. But I think what happened was I was writing a bunch of separate riffs, like maybe I do a whole thing on my distant relative, Joseph Schildkraut, who was actor on the Yiddish stage and then in Broadway and then in Hollywood. So I did a riff on him. And then I did a thing on my interest in women wearing eyeglasses. I was oddly fascinated by women's eyeglasses. And then I would do these separate riffs, like a thing on, I don't know, a childhood joke that pivoted on the word radio, or, you know, all these riffs. And I was telling myself, oh, well, those are just digressions from the novel. And for year after year, I would tell myself, well, don't worry, author, you know, you're going to build in that novelistic structure. And I sort of realized at some point, and I think oddly, it had something to do with my daughter being born. You know, she was born in 93. You know, it sounds like you guys both have daughters. I don't want to turn into some kind of sentimental narrative about that. But I think partly is just the time it takes to raise a child, but also just the, as they say, the undeniable reality of her existence. I don't think that was a coincidence that part of her birth in 93, and then having less time, having a very full teaching schedule, and then just somehow just reality seemed kind of thrillingly interesting, you know, via her. And then rather a long-winded answer to your question, but I think the fundamental fact of it was I was writing dozens, even hundreds of digressions from one page long to maybe 10 or 15 pages long. And at a certain point, I realized there was no there. There wasn't really a novelistic narrative. And what little gestures I made in that direction seemed incredibly obligatory. I just seemed awfully half-hearted, I guess. Like, oh, I had this idea that maybe the narrator was maybe a film critic for his local paper. Maybe his wife or girlfriend was maybe a media studies teacher at a high school or something like that. And they would argue about media, shows, TV. They would sort of live their emotional life strangely through media, which, of course, 30 years later, it's something we all do to a staggering degree. But I realized I wasn't interested in the conflict between the husband and wife. I was interested in the conflict within myself, my sort of deep ambivalence or love hate toward, let's call it, you know, American popular culture or American mass media. I think I was heavily influenced by the rise of a discussion about the essay form in the U.S. People like Philip Lope, Vivian Gornick, John DeGatta were talking about the excitement of the essay form, both in their work and interviews, anthologies. And I realized I'm more interested in staging that ambivalence, exploring that ambivalence in an essayistic way through myself. And I'm less prone, alas, you know, to stage it as a scenic drama between two human beings or six human beings. It's kind of the fundamental difference between an essayist, a book-length essayist, which I think of myself as being, and someone who really does love fictional drama. It was a real sort of classic moment for me. And, I thought it was a one-off thing where, okay, now I'll go back to my novel or another novel. But over the last, 25, 30 years, I've become someone who theorizes about the essay form, works in it. And so that was a very key moment to me.
Were you concerned about that sort of step, the sort of idea that it was supposed to be a novel and that you felt you were moving away from it? Or were you sort of secure that the content was just finding the form that it needed and that it was sort of evolving in that direction, and peace with that, or did it cause anxiety?
I think it's a very intuitive question, which isn't a big surprise because you're a writer of fiction, and it's sort of an easy answer, but obviously both. I was terribly ashamed and embarrassed and mortified. I mean, I was teaching in creative writing program as supposedly a fiction writer. And then also I was very sort of metaphysically invested in the idea that unlike my parents, I was a writer of inventive fictions and not a mere transcriber of reality. You know, I'm very invested in totally cross-wiring those ideas now and really rejecting those premises. At the same time, I really did feel, I mean, it's one of the proudest moments in my writing life is that I did allow the book to find its form. I think that's exactly right. And that I kind of shook a proverbial rabbit out of the hat. I thought the book had died, and out of its demise, I shook this kind of alive rabbit, I think, to mix many metaphors. And I think it's a good book. Again, I haven't reread it, and it's in print with, I think, a university press, but I think it's a good alive book, and I think it consists of 52 chapters. And I think in many ways, I did feel like, God, that's so cool. I didn't just ramrod through a quasi novel. I really listened to the material, and I allowed, you know, I sort of literally had 3x5 cards all around my office and just said, my God, it's a book of essay of nonfiction. And I was heavily influenced. I was watching and teaching and studying a lot of documentary films, self-reflexive documentary film, people especially like Ross McElwee, Adam, I forget if Adam Curtis was releasing stuff yet, but I've become a huge Curtis fan, Errol Morris. And I think that had a big influence too, in which I wanted a self-reflexive narrator, author, speaker to be part of the material, both manipulating the material and being manipulated by the material. I mean, just a really crucial moment for me was seeing McElwee's film, Sherman's March. I don't know if you guys know that film.
No.
Quite great. It's just a huge, huge, huge influence on me. I said, you know, that's what I want to be doing. And that was as early as 1990 or so. It took me a while for my work to catch up with what I was really loving, because I was so, you know, I don't know what you guys feel like. Does this culture still have this weird hierarchy of the novel, sort of. I mean, I resist that hugely. But Annie Ernaux, say, winning the Nobel Prize, is she a novelist? Not really, but somehow she's called one. I mean, I guess she's written some fiction, but essentially an essayist to me. I mean, I don't love everything she's written, but some books of hers I really like. I do think I was heavily under the sway of capital N novel means you're an artist. And if you're writing nonfiction, then you're, you know, just your parents' progeny or something. And so I do exist in this curious hybrid space where I'm really hugely resistant to the banalities of journalism and memoir and standard scholarship. But I'm also, there aren't very many novels I really love of a conventional kind.
I think there's been a change just generally in terms of how novels are received and how novelists are sort of perceived in the abstract within society. And certainly over the period from when you made this shift until now. And I think novelists are less sort of revered as prophet or purveyor of truths within society generally. They're seen as entertainment providers, content providers in the main, whereas there was a role going back sort of 50 years or so that I think seems a very different world in which the phrase "I'm a novelist" carried a different weight than it would now. Right?
We've talked in the past about how the main sort of storytelling mode that people go to is film and TV now. So I think, I mean, we're both of us running the show are sort of interested in people doing more interesting things with particularly fiction as a form, but nonfiction. That seems the novel itself does seem quite moribund. I never want to go for this death of the novel thing because I think it's nonsense. But in terms of reading a very conventional novel, I don't know. It feels like it's not so essential now as it might have been. And I'm not quite sure what's changed. I just think there are other things doing that, the generative creative work for you.
Obviously, I just have to read your novel, how you solve that for yourself. If your work exists, you know, in relationship to something like, I don't know, some other way that you describe it, it sounds a little bit like, say, Flaubert's Parrot or something like that, is have a bit of that feel.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting novel.
I agree. I remember liking that book and a lot. I must admit, I reread it recently. I didn't love it as much, but that would be, you know, the element that would be as fictional as I would tend, which is not much of a novel. It's a wonderful meditation on Flaubert, I think, but is it a novel? Sorta. I mean, why not? Call it whatever you want.
It's interesting thing you were saying about you were speaking to a writer friend who was saying to you, like, don't call it a novel at the moment. Like, you know, you need to sort of work with it. Because I wonder if that's kind of in the eye of the creator. Because there are just some things that people, I mean, Sarah Baum, who we've spoken to, who has freely admitted that her work is just quite autobiographical. She's just writing about a time in her life. She packages it together. That's a novel. The criteria for that is because she's decides that that's what it is.
And just changes names for legal reasons and that's it.
In one person's head, changing the name is you've made it a novel. You've invested the creative element into writing this down and then you change a name and it's a novel. Another person would anguish about, even though they've changed the name, it's clearly autobiographical.
Right.
It's non-fiction. It's nothing to do with fiction. But in their head, they're a piece of non-fiction and put a very thin veneer of a couple of name changes on the top.
I remember being on a panel with Nicholson Baker, whose work I really do like. There's some books of his I like very much. I mean, as with anyone, other books less so. But in general, I think of myself as a huge fan of his. And but he was saying, to my surprise, I guess, a little bit, he was saying, if he changed, I mean, it seemed almost impossible someone would believe this, but he said, if he had changed a single detail, I think we were talking about like his novel, like Room Temperature, which is about a man taking care of his infant child and just has various thoughts about life while he's feeding her a bottle. And he said, like, if he had changed a single detail in it, such as that he wears black trainers rather than white trainers, that makes it a novel. Like that to me is ludicrous. And I guess what's even more ludicrous is my weird investment. Like to me, it's like, I don't know. I really care. Like, I don't know. It's very odd that I care, partly because I've made this transition of sorts, or not even of sorts, from fiction to essay, book length essay. And then for some reason, when certain books, I want to somehow I'm both against genre, but oddly loyal to the essay genre. I'm a bit of a mixed bag. Like something like, I don't hugely love Zabel the way you think I would or should. Or for me, I read it again, maybe for Zabel, if he changes a few details, and maybe I think he does labor or did labor under maybe a European valorization of the novel. I think in Germany, those books were just published as literature, not as novel. I forget how they appeared in England. Do you guys recall?
They're certainly sold as novels, but like with the blurb and the sort of introductions and everything, that they are to be taken as strictly very accurate depictions.
At this point, I don't know, maybe that we're beyond genre.
The way you've described it, that kind of encapsulates the shift from one perspective to another.
You mean encapsulates the shift within me or the culture or both?
Well, within you, but it's interesting to sort of pull on some threads there to see, I guess, where it leads in terms of the differences. I'm just wondering if there was any shift in your kind of practical approach to writing words down. And you mentioned sort of 6 to 8 year period you were working on this loosely, and at the start, starting out writing a novel, and by the end, you weren't. Did any kind of shift take place in terms of your practical day-to-day way of writing, where you changed? And how, I guess, has it since changed in that you go about the job of putting words down in a different way now that you're thinking of it as essayistic, or thinking about it in this different way? Or was there no difference in terms of the practical side?
Indeed, of course, it has changed. Partly, somewhat bafflingly, you know, that I publish more frequently than I had. I think, you know, maybe between ages 25 and 40 or so, published a book maybe every 3, 4, 5 years. You know, it's like, be like a real long gestation period between each book, 80 to 84, then 84 to 89, 89 to 92, 92 to 96. So like, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. And then I don't know what it was then. It took me a while, but you know, now I probably publish a book every year or two, typically, you know, not necessarily every year, but more frequently. And so I do think the process has shifted. I'm trying to think of how.
Are you publishing more because you've got less sort of, you're deleting, or you know, you're writing 100,000 words and then paring it down to 10,000 when you're writing a novel, and now the 100,000 words come out. Okay, that's good. Good to go and it gets published? Or I mean, has the editing process changed at all, I guess, and or the amount of words?
I ended up writing this long, page-long riff about how I compose a work of literary collage, and found myself saying relatively precisely how I go about it. Some of it's somewhat counterintuitive. When a colleague asked if I have any sort of tried and true compositional methodology when it comes to literary collage, I found myself emailing back in about 5 minutes this curiously complete summary. And please, you guys, break in if you want to investigate any of these terms. I'll stumble into a metaphor that, in my grandiosity, I think explains the universe, at least for me, at least the moment. Some large subject will represent for me a personal, cultural, and human, quote, crisis, something about which I'm confused, ambivalent, embarrassed, ashamed, excited. Obviously, Reality Hunger would fit that, or my book on New York Times war photography, or this book on mortality I wrote, or a book on sexuality, a book on race. Anyway, quite a few of my books kind of have these grandiose, huge topics. I'll then shoot a lot of film, gather hundreds or even thousands of pages over many years, sometimes over many decades, just stuff I've read, old stuff I wrote, new stuff I'm writing, emails from friends, research, etc. All of which puts, quote, pressure on the material, some supposedly enormous subject. I won't really know what I want to say about it. I just know it's tugging at me and I need to explore it. I've convinced myself I have something or other to add to the conversation. At a certain point, I'll no longer be surprised by shooting more film. It will all be telling me the same thing. So I'll stop and reread and reread. Often the page count goes down very quickly from, say, 3,000 pages down to, say, 1,000, then 500, then 300, then 140. At 140, maybe it's a book. No literary collage can be longer than 120 pages, jokes. Or to mix metaphor, I mean, I think there is something true about that form, this delicate glass sculpture. It's a beautiful form in a microcosm. Spread out to 600 pages, it can feel like a very baggy thing. There are counterexamples. I don't know if you guys know and like Simon Gray's Smoking Diaries as much as I do. Is that a book that you guys know?
No, I'll check it out.
Oh my God. Do you know the British playwright who, he's kind of a middling British playwright, but in his last a few years, he published this 4-volume Smoking Diaries, which is one of my favorite books ever. It's published by Grant in the UK. Anyway, to mix metaphors, you're getting rid of all the draws, all the easy things, all the obvious things. You keep only what scares you. You know, that's obviously a very meaningful term, this idea of writing in uncomfortableness, I guess. Then you start pouring the paragraphs you like into different thematic silos, different rubrics. And you organize each of these rubrics so that each of these rubrics or silos or holding tanks has its own trajectory. Each one is in a way its own mini essay. Then you arrange the silos either vertically or horizontally, i.e. as consecutive chapters going downward, as say Gene Toomer does in Cain. I don't know if you guys know that book. I think of that as vertical. He's an African-American writer of the 20s and 30s. I think, you know, you can think of Flaubert's Parrot sort of works that way. Or you arrange it horizontally across space, as, say, Amy Fusselman does in The Pharmacist's Maid. I think I'm trying to give an example you guys might know that feels more like, I think of Annie Ernaux's book, Things Seen, if you know that book, sort of feels like that. It's basically either A, B, 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 C, 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 D, 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 or it's A, B, C, D, A, E, B, B, D, B, D, C, A, D. Easiest thing in the world. Nothing is more difficult and more beautiful. So anyway, that's maybe a little highfalutin. But when Lachlan asked that question, I mean, that's the answer. That's how I pretty much write now.
I can understand that relating to your writing now. When you think back to when you were writing novels in the 80s, that I can't quite map that onto the process of writing a novel.
Not at all.
Were you writing in a different way then as a novelist?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think to circle back a bit, what happened, of course, in writing Remote, my would-be fourth novel, I was trying to write it as a work of fiction, but it sort of segued into this. Like, basically, that was the first time I started using this method without even knowing it. And over time, it sort of solidified, alas, into my working method. But as I was writing my first three novels, Heroes, very traditional novel, Dead Languages, you know, I think it's a better book, but it's still somewhat straitjacketed by the fact that it's a buildings roman, and Handbook for Drowning, a novel and stories, which both gestures toward conventional stories, some of which are pretty solidly made, and then other ones which are very sort of collagey, and some of which feel very essayistic. That book is looking back and also a bit of a premonition of where I was going to head soon. But as I wrote those three books, Lachlan, I was writing them, you know, in the way probably Jamie was writing his novel, which is just open a document, or at the early books in the 80s and 90s, you know, you would type them up and would write a draft of Dead Languages, say, or Heroes or Handbook for Drowning as, I don't know what you call it, just consecutive typing, where you'd write Dead Languages, say, was a 400-page novel, and I edited it down to 250 or something like that. But certainly it went through draft after draft. I mean, I think of myself as only an okay writer, but I think of myself as a pretty good rewriter. Like, I have fairly endless patience with the revision process. I do feel like I have I can revise endlessly, maybe too much so. But, you know, I mean, I wrote Dead Languages, the growing up novel about stuttering. I was in speech therapy and I was writing the novel almost in effect to the speech therapist, because they did not want me talking about emotional things in speech therapy. They wanted me to concentrate entirely on technical matters of the speech mechanism. And it was like this perfect mechanism, which, because I couldn't, you know, it was very important to me to learn how to gain control of my speech, but they forbade any discussion of the emotional life. I mean, you couldn't have created a more perfect lab. Poor person has to write the novels. Otherwise, you know, that wonderful line of Marguerite Duras, who calls writing a silent screaming. And, you know, it's like, internally, I was sort of screaming like, I want to talk about all this stuff. They go, no, we're not talking about this. This is not psychoanalysis. This is speech therapy. we're going to teach you how to create more air pressure under your subglottal folds. I'm like, okay, but can I talk about my childhood? No, absolutely not. So in a way, that birthed my second novel, Dead Languages. And, you know, it was this long, very autobiographical novel, but it's still definitely a novel. And that was a really important book to me because I think it was the first book with my own voice, with my own story. Heroes, that first book, was pretty conventional. I was really trying to be, not consciously, but I was trying to be a very traditional, conventional novelist. That book doesn't have that much of me in it, in my opinion.
You were talking about the way that you are finding material and just putting things together in a sort of silo. I guess things start to sift themselves into a silo. Maybe there's an unconscious process going there. When it gets to the point of it's expanded and expanded and expanded. These are sort of intuitive gut things that I think lots of writers hate talking about. So I appreciate how difficult it might be to answer. But how, firstly, do you get a sense that you've got enough material to go through? And then when you're going back through it, reducing it, what's the sort of process? How systematic is that?
I know what you mean. There's at least three steps, maybe 300, but there's one where you have this sort of, you hope, a bit of a frenzy of an idea that feels very urgent. Like I remember when I, you know, wanted to do a book, this book, War is Beautiful, the New York Times Pictorial Guide to the Glamour of Armed Conflict. I just knew I had to do a book on what struck me as sort of the pornographic beauty of New York Times front page war photographs. It just grabbed me. So there's that moment. Then there's the moment. It takes quite a while where it's just, you're just gathering stuff, you know, somewhat reportorial or quasi-journalistically or self-reflexively, but you're just gathering stuff over days, weeks, months, years. And that the exciting part of that is that you, as you say, Jamie, you're teaching yourself what the material is. You're making connections without being consciously aware of them. To me, that's fine, but kind of nerve-wracking because you don't know what the material is doing, and you hope you're not just a pack rat who's gathering all this stuff. But, you know, over time, I've learned where to look for where the proverbial bodies are buried. And so, I mean, how do you know when you have enough? There's a point at which you feel like the material is no longer, you know, first of all, you feel like you are making these connections, albeit conscious ones. And then there's also a point at which you feel like, well, there's no point, frankly, in writing more or reading more or researching more. The material sort of has shown itself in all of its paradoxical unity. Like it has weird walls around it. Many of these topics could be endlessly explored, you know, mass media. How do you create a wall around that, or mortality, or war photography, or human sexuality? Obviously, you could read about this indefinitely, but there's a certain point, it seems to me, where the kind of paradoxical conundrum that is driving the material somehow resolves into a bit of, for lack of a better term, dialectic. It feels like there's a sort of synthesis going on. And then, you know, that your task as the writer is to try to unpack that synthesis, convey it to yourself and the reader, and of course, not have it be too simplistic or simplified. I don't know if those terms are too abstract, but, you know, it's this gathering, this siloing that is nevertheless, as you say, you're kind of intuitively making these connections. And then at a certain point, you feel like, I don't know whether you just have run out of steam or you found that whatever the book has to contribute, it's made its incision, and that everything else at that point is mere data that is supporting your essential ideas. Like, I don't know, this recent book which I'm just finishing called All the Best Stories Are True, Documentary Film as Suicide Prevention Hotline. I thought I would write about hundreds of documentary films, and I've written about quite a few, maybe 50 or 60, but I thought I would write about hundreds and try and be weirdly complete about it. You know, obviously you could discuss every documentary film, it's absurd, but perhaps every so-called crucial one or important ones. To my surprise, I mean, the book is still long. It's 300 pages. It's 90,000 words. It's the longest book I've written for a while, but it's much shorter than I thought it would be. And something just rounded itself off. The sort of
psychic or spiritual metaphysical journey of the book had been completed. And yes, I could watch 200 more films and may indeed end up watching those films. And I guess it's possible I'll add a chapter or two or three, but there was a movement to the book that felt to me, I hope to the reader, complete. I don't know if any of these terms make any sense to you at all, but that's the best I can do.
Once you've got to that point and you just feel like, whether it is that you've had your fill or it just feels like that it's coherently there in a way, with your editing process, does that tend to be a really kind of sculpting the block you've already got process? I'm trying to think of a better metaphor for it. Or you're still going to go through and realize there's something that's not quite connecting two bits, so you want to go and find something else that would fit there? Or have you sort of done all the extraction of the raw material and then it's giving it the form?
I mean, you're making crucial connections. Like this book that I've just finished, you know, on documentary film, it has 35 chapters, and each one is meant to be a subtle, incremental psychic leap forward. Very subtly so, but there's a thread, there's a clear narrative thread about kind of a journey to hell and back is supposed to be what is underlying the book. And each chapter took me forever to figure it out. Although the book only took 3 years, it was three quite concentrated COVID shadowed years. The last 3 years, pretty much, I did very little else but work on this book. Pretty late in the process, I realized what should have been obvious, that the book can't just be a series of overlapping chapters exploring the material over and over again, but I had to lay in the chapters in just the right order and make explicit what the narrative leap was in each chapter. So there was really crucial stitch work, which I hope is successful. My agent is reading it now.
Does that involve a lot? So going back to the idea of the silos that you were talking about, of putting things into the silos, is there a lot of going back and rummaging around and pulling things out of one silo and moving them into another?
Hugely. I mean, there are certain quotes I use a lot, but one is, this Picasso line, he says, you know, a great painting comes together just barely. And it's that just barely that I really love. And you're like, the book, I hope, comes together, you know, like just barely, but really firmly. And so I think there's a lot. I mean, there's so many radical changes in the book. I mean, they may not seem radical to the reader. It goes, yeah, of course the book came out this way. That would be ideal, where the reader feels effortlessly like, oh, yeah, okay. It's 35 chapters and, you know, it tells about documentary film and it traces a certain path through the author's life and it's meant to be metaphorical. But there's so much, to go back to our early discussion, so many poetic liberties I took to make the book work. I mean, to take the most obvious example, chapters I wrote very, very, very early on, just getting started, become the last two chapters of the book in which I come to these revelations very late in the book, when in fact they were the very chapters that began the book. And there's a lot of delicate skullduggery one has to do to hide one's footsteps.
Going back to that just barely, the hiding the footsteps or the not hiding them is the beauty of essay or fiction. So we've talked about on the podcast before, in terms of fiction writing, there's a sort of industry of creative fiction teaching and correct way to kind of plot and create narrative, and it's sort of treated almost as a science that can be passed down, and that can quite often lose something, and that magic of that just barely, when you read something great, just barely is almost tangible. You can feel the author, the hesitation or the footsteps that are just almost visible beneath the snow, but are kind of covered over hurriedly as the author moves on to the next section.
I know. That's so beautiful.
No. Yeah, I think that just barely is important, isn't it?
It's a great line. And like, I mean, you captured so well why maybe I overreacted to fictions for some reason in my hands. Obviously, in certain people's hands, it becomes a live form, and certain people have figured out a way to make it work for them as a serious intellectual instrument. Or I could have pivoted toward a more essayistic kind of Nicholson Baker-esque, or, you know, Julian Barnes-esque kind of, Henry Green-esque kind of novel, maybe. But for some reason, a lot of fiction I was reading, a lot of fiction I was teaching, I just felt like, no, it, you know, the proverbial game doesn't seem to be worth the candle here. There's so much is done in the name of character building and scene setting and backstory and narrative. It's like, well, why am I even writing this book? Is it simply to hold the reader's attention? Wrap? And of course, in very good writer's hands, you know, you can think of, I don't know, I always think of like The Death of Ivan Illich for some reason, because like that's a serious novella. He's not kidding around, you know. And when it's magisterial like that, it seems to have a purpose. But even in writers who are supposedly admired, often feel or felt like, really, why exactly are we reading this? It seems to be a form of sort of verisimilitude / page turning. And for some reason, I just hit a dead end with it. And that I do feel like this sort of excitement of the very best work of either autobiographical fiction or so-called autofiction, which I'm not a big fan of that term at all, or simply book-length essay, which I think is a perfectly fine term. And you do feel, as you say, Lachlan, that wonderful, that just barely is both hidden, but you can just feel it like, oh my God, the writer's making this connection here. It's always a feeling I have, the difference between Camus and Sartre. I really love Camus and don't particularly like Sartre's fiction, but Camus was a great writer, I think. I do love The Fall a lot, that book in particular. To me, Camus is making discoveries as he goes. You can feel him making the connections just barely. Whereas Sartre, he knows what he thinks and he's just writing fiction to prove it. And it's, to me, completely dead on arrival. You know, even at, like an influential book like Nausea, he's not making any connections. He's trying to prove, you know, trying to demonstrate existentialism. And maybe it's useful as a philosophical primer, but to me, it just feels really dead. Whereas Camus, The Fall is really, to me, that Camus-Sartre distinction is a useful one along those terms. Mm. But anyway, just yesterday, I changed the last few sentences of the book. To my surprise, I was just swimming and I felt like the ending is just not quite right. I'm going to bring in this quote from nowhere, which had been in the dustbin of the book. I'm like, you know, I'm going to slide this in. And I just am living with it now, of course. I'm trepidatious that I might have ruined the ending, but I think it's a good or better ending.
Okay, well, thank you to David Shields for joining us way back at the start of summer in 2023. And thank you for listening. I hope everyone is well and has been living their best lives in the hiatus that we took before coming back. We now have episodes lined up that we'll be bringing out for the coming months over 2024. We're back to the monthly schedule. So please spread the word on social media, like, subscribe, write us a review. It all helps. It all helps us get noticed in the incredibly crowded marketplace. You can follow us at Unsound Methods on the site that I'm going to continue to call Twitter. And we have our website, unsoundmethods.co.uk.
Do follow us. We'll tease some of the upcoming authors that are going to be released in the coming months as well. You can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com or also on Twitter at Lachlan Bloom.
You can find my writing. I've got the website, jamiebatchin.com, that my New Year's resolution should be to maintain a bit more and update. I'm on @JamieBatchin on Twitter.